So imagine you're walking into this incredibly lush, dense, tropical forest.
Right, like a total paradise.
Exactly, a total postcard.
Yeah.
The air is super thick, it's saturated with like 84% humidity. You can smell the wet earth, the salt spray from the ocean just right there.
Oh, yeah.
And towering up all around you are these jagged limestone cliffs, just completely swallowed up by thick green vines and this massive broadleaf canopy. Visually, it is stunning.
Oh, there's a catch.
A huge one. As you're standing there, something starts to feel, well, deeply and fundamentally wrong.
The sound.
Yes, the sound, or actually the complete lack of it, it is eerily, totally silent. I mean, you're in a jungle, but there are no birds singing. Nothing is rustling in the canopy above you. It's just this heavy, almost suffocating quiet.
It's unsettling to even think about.
It really is. And the reason for that silence, if you look up into the trees, perfectly camouflaged in that dense foliage, there are up to 20 invasive brown tree snakes per acre.
Which is an absolutely staggering biological density.
Right. And across this entire island, which is only, 210 square miles, there's an estimated population of 2.68 million of these apex predators.
Just, I mean, to put that into perspective for you, the listener, we are looking at an island ecosystem that has been completely saturated. It's fundamentally re-engineered by this single invasive species operating in a total evolutionary vacuum.
Yeah, and today we are going to look at exactly how you fight back against a biological takeover of that insane scale. So, welcome to our deep dive.
Glad to be here.
We have a really fascinating mission today. We are unpacking this giant stack of internal business plans, technical blueprints, and white papers from a joint venture known as Sovereign Eradication Services, or SES.
And their objective is basically straight out of a science fiction novel.
Oh, 100%. They aren't just trying to, like, control the snake population. They are executing a fully autonomous 10-year project to completely eradicate the brown tree snake from the island of Guam. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
Because what makes this project so mind-bending isn't just that massive goal, it's the tools they're using to do it. We're looking at this wild collaboration between a rugged tactical hardware company called Pawnee Mobility.
The muscle, basically.
Right, the muscle. And they're paired up with a decentralized edge computing AI company named Deriticular.
And the documentation we have reveals just a complete paradigm shift
Yeah.
in how we approach ecological restoration.
Yeah, they're totally throwing out the old playbook.
Exactly. We are moving entirely away from traditional manual pest control. Instead, we're looking at the integration of these virtually indestructible off-road vehicles paired with air-gaffed artificial intelligence.
Which is wild.
It is.
Yeah.
And that AI manages autonomous drone swarms to literally hunt snakes in the pitch black of night.
And okay, the part that really broke my brain when I was reading through the sources was the economics. They are paying for all of this using a, and this sounds made up, a paper snake cryptocurrency financial model.
Backed by federal funds.
Backed by federal funds. And global biodiversity credits. I mean, it sounds completely insane until you read the mechanics of how it actually functions. But before we get into the robotic drone swarms and the blockchain ledgers, we really need to understand the biological reality on the ground.
Right, the context is everything here.
Yeah. Why is the US government forced to deploy a robotic swarm army in the first place? Like, why did traditional pest control completely and utterly fail on Guam?
Well, to understand that failure, we have to look at the initial conditions of the invasion. We have to go all the way back to the years immediately following World War II.
Right, at late 1940s.
Exactly. The brown tree snake, which is native to places like Australia and Papua New Guinea, it accidentally hitchhiked to Guam. The leading theory documented in our sources is that it was a stowaway in salvaged military cargo.
Or like surplus aircraft, right?
Yeah, surplus aircraft arriving at the port of Apra. And when it arrived, I mean, it found an ecological paradise.
Because there were no natural predators.
None. Guam had no native tree climbing snakes. It had no large reptilian predators at all. The native birds and lizards had absolutely no defensive behaviors against a nocturnal arboreal predator.
They just didn't know they were supposed to be afraid of a snake in a tree.
Exactly. It was an all-you-can-eat buffet. And the snakes just multiplied unchecked.
The numbers in the documents are just tragic. The snake drove 10 of Guam's 12 native forest bird species to total local extinction in the wild.
Gone.
Yeah, species like the Guam flycatcher, the Guam rail, the Guam kingfisher, just completely wiped out. Today, only two native species, the Mariana swiftlet and the Micronesian starling, which is also known as the soli, they only managed to survive in these highly restricted, heavily managed reserves.
And that loss of avian life, it triggered a profound trophic cascade.
A trophic cascade. Explain that for the listener, real quick.
So, in ecology, when you remove a key piece of the food web, the effects ripple outward in really unexpected ways. For instance, without birds to eat insects, the spider populations on Guam just exploded.
Oh, I read that part. It's nightmare fuel.
It really is. The field research notes that in Guam's forests, spider web densities are up to 40 times higher than on neighboring snake-free islands.
40 times! That's insane!
But more critically for the long-term survival of the island itself, about 70% of Guam's native forest tree species rely completely on fruit-eating birds.
Right, to consume their fruit, digest it, and spread the seeds.
Exactly. They need the birds to consume the fruit, digest and scarify the seeds in their stomachs, and disperse them across the island.
Yeah, and that scarification part is crucial, right? Like, the seed's hard outer shell has to be broken down by the bird's stomach acid so it can actually germinate when it hits the dirt.
Precisely. Without those birds flying around and distributing the seeds just fall directly beneath the parent trees.
Where they rot.
They rot, or they die from resource competition or, soil pathogens. The data shows new tree seedling recruitment has dropped by a devastating 92%.
Wow.
The forest is literally losing its ability to regenerate. It's becoming a retirement home for old trees.
Which is why the government has spent decades trying to intervene. But this is where they hit a brutal biological bottleneck.
Yeah, the Cocos Island case study.
Yes, the documents detail this incredible case study from an islet just off the southern coast of Guam called Cocos Island, or Dunnoll Islet. It was designed to be this safe refuge for endangered birds. But in 2020, researchers discovered a breeding population of brown tree snakes had somehow made it there.
So the wildlife agencies went in with the standard playbook, right? Traps and poison bait.
And their poison of choice is fascinating to me. It's acetaminophen, like literally Tylenol.
It is highly effective on a physiological level, actually. The brown tree snake is uniquely sensitive to acetaminophen. Just an 80 milligram dose, which is, a fraction of a standard human pill inserted into a dead neonatal mouse carcass, is totally lethal to them.
It causes a condition called methemoglobinemia?
Methemoglobinemia, yeah.
Right, I had to look up how that actually works. From what I understand, the acetaminophen basically breaks the snake's blood, like it oxidizes the iron in the snake's hemoglobin.
That's spot on. Normally, hemoglobin binds to oxygen in the lungs and carries it to the organs. But when that iron is oxidized, it just can't grab the oxygen anymore.
So they suffocate.
It leads to rapid systemic cellular hypoxia. The snake basically falls asleep and passes away very quickly and humanely.
Right. And to deliver this, researchers drop these laced mice carcasses from helicopters using these specialized biodegradable cardboard rotors.
Which is a brilliant design. Those rotors are designed to snag in the upper tree canopy where the snakes hunt. That keeps the toxic bait away from non-target ground animals, like coconut crabs or feral pigs.
Okay, so they have this highly effective, very targeted delivery system. And on Cocos Island, they went all in. They set up an absolute gauntlet. They dropped over 2,400 of these carrion baits.
A massive effort.
Yeah, and they set up over 10,500 trap nights using passive cage traps. You would think they wiped out the entire population.
You would think so.
But after all of that immense effort, they caught exactly one snake, just one, and zero baits were consumed by the snakes. Not a single one.
Which, as you can imagine, completely baffled the teams initially. Because simultaneous visual nighttime searches with spotlights confirmed that the island absolutely had a highly active breeding population of snakes.
Right, the snakes were there.
They were absolutely just slithering right past the traps. They just completely ignored the dead mice in the cages.
Okay, what's fascinating here is that this specific failure leads us to the critical bottleneck identified by the researchers, which they call the prey abundance trap.
The prey abundance trap, exactly.
This concept is basically the key to everything that follows in this deep dive. When I read it, I pictured like trying to offer a stale saltine cracker to someone who is currently sitting at an all-you-can-eat Vegas buffet holding a plate of prime rib.
That's a perfect way to visualize it.
Of course, they won't take the cracker.
The biological reality perfectly mirrors your analogy. The snakes on Cocos Island were surrounded by an extreme abundance of live, high-quality prey, endemic geckos and, you know, the very nesting birds the island was meant to protect.
Their predatory drive was just fully saturated?
Yes. A cold, dead mouse carcass laced with acetaminophen simply does not trigger their strike response when there is fresh, warm prey scurrying everywhere.
And there's a metabolic factor too, right?
Crucially, yes. A well-fed brown tree snake will remain highly inactive for 5 to 7 days while digesting a large meal. Their metabolism slows way down, and they hide deep in the foliage.
So they aren't even moving around.
Right. This means they simply aren't moving around enough to passively encounter the cage traps scattered in the environment.
So if you are listening to this and wondering, hey, why doesn't the government just carpet bomb the island with poison mice to fix the problem? Well, this is exactly why. Traditional passive baiting only works in the highly degraded silent forests of mainland Guam, where the birds are already totally gone and the snakes are literally starving to death.
Right, they'll eat anything there.
Yeah, but in intact ecosystems or in areas where you actively want to rebuild the bird population, the biology of a satiated predator renders poison and passive traps completely useless.
Mm-hmm.
Biology defeats the trap. You literally have to actively hunt them down one by one.
And the recognition of that specific biological bottleneck is what forced a total strategic pivot. The Department of Defense, DARPA, the Marines, and the Strategic Environmental Research and Development Program, AIRS-ABL, they realized that deploying human teams to manually spotlight snakes at night was far too slow.
And prohibitively expensive.
Oh, absolutely. And logistically impossible across dense vertical jungles. So they launched an open innovation challenge. They essentially asked the private sector, how do we automate the active hunting of a highly cryptic, nocturnal predator across hundreds of thousands of acres of hostile terrain?
And if human teams can't hike through abrasive limestone jungles in the middle of the night to hand capture snakes, you need to build a robotic ecosystem to do it for you. Which brings us to the hardware. This is where Pawnee Mobility enters the picture. They provide the physical layer of this eradication, stack the muscle.
In the engineering documents, Pawnee lays out what they call the current state versus target state gap analysis.
Right.
Pawnee already had a proven track record of building incredible off-road vehicles designed for, like, high-speed Baja desert racing and expansive agricultural ranches.
But Guam is not a dry desert.
Not at all. The target environment of Guam is exceptionally hostile to mechanical hardware. A vehicle designed for a dry, sandy desert will simply disintegrate in a tropical limestone jungle.
I found the details of that gap analysis so fascinating. We are just talking about driving through some mud. The interior of Guam is deep, roadless jungle built on karst limestone. And this limestone acts like industrial sandpaper.
It really does.
If a steel undercarriage scrapes against it, it shreds the protective coatings instantly. Add to that the constant 84% humidity and salt spray carried in from the Pacific Ocean, and you have a recipe for disaster.
The technical term they use is galvanic corrosion.
Right, explain that for me.
So when you have dissimilar metals in contact with each other in the presence of an electrolyte-like salt water, one metal acts as an anode and corrodes rapidly to protect the other. The gap analysis showed that standard vehicle components would experience catastrophic failure due to galvanic corrosion within 90 days in that specific environment.
90 days? That's nothing for a 10-year project.
Yeah.
So Pawnee had to completely re-engineer their platforms from the ground up to bridge that gap. They developed what they call mobile tactical command centers, or MTCCs.
Yes, these are ultralight tactical electric vehicles, or UTVs.
And they feature these crazy range-extended hybrid rotary engines that act as mobile generators.
Yeah.
But to survive the limestone, they stripped out the standard aluminum skid plates entirely.
And replaced them with Deuterocular's ogre skin armor?
Yeah, ogre skin polymer composite armor.
The material science behind ogre skin is a vital component here. It is an ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene, or UHMWPE composite.
That's a mouthful.
It is, but it's highly functional because it is self-lubricating and entirely non-corrosive.
It's essentially like coating the bottom of the truck in a material that acts like Teflon rather than Velcro. Like, instead of the limestone catching the metal and tearing it, the ogre skin literally lets the 2-ton vehicle slide over jagged, razor-sharp rocks without scraping or losing any momentum.
Which is incredible.
Yeah.
Furthermore, they address the corrosion issue by sealing all the spherical bearings in the suspension with double-lip nitrile boots to keep out the abrasive volcanic clay.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and they swapped every standard steel fastener on the vehicle for marine-grade titanium.
Titanium fasteners?
They basically built an indestructible rolling fortress designed to live indefinitely in a salt spray jungle.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. These command centers aren't just driving around aimlessly. Their flatbeds are heavily retrofitted with automated hangar bays.
They're mobile aircraft carriers.
Literally. From these hubs, they deploy the actual hunters. First, you have the curb cars. These are rugged, low-signature, autonomous ground rovers, also clad in ogre skin armor.
Right, they sweep the forest floor to retrieve the dead snakes.
Yeah, but the real active squeeze comes from the air. They are deploying 2,500 Genoptic vertical takeoff and landing VTOL drones.
2,500.
These drones launch directly from the UTV flatbeds, fly up into the canopy, hunt the snakes, and then return to the flatbeds to autonomously recharge.
The scale of the mechanics is just daunting. We are talking about 12 mobile command centers, 50 curb car rovers, and 2,500 drones executing a coordinated continuous sweep across the island.
Okay, I need to stop you right there, because as I was reading this part of the blueprint, my brain completely short-circuited on the logistics of that.
How so?
Well, if you have 2,500 drones flying constant sorties, dozens of rovers, and 12 mobile bases operating deep in a roadless jungle, miles away from any paved infrastructure, how on earth are you fueling them?
A very valid question.
If you have to constantly drive diesel supply trucks back and forth from the naval base to refill these generators, you are defeating the entire purpose of an autonomous system. You'd just be creating a vast, highly vulnerable supply line that requires human drivers.
The project architects, a team led by hardware and systems engineers, identified that exact logistical vulnerability. They termed it the energy and distribution deficit.
Okay, so how did they fix it?
To solve it, they didn't look for better batteries. They looked for off-grid generation. They integrated technology from a partner called Agridot Energy.
Agridot.
Yes, and Agridot provides these trailer-mounted microgeneration stations that utilize plasma gasification.
Okay, plasma gasification. When I first read that, it sounded like a plasma rifle from a video game. How does that actually generate fuel?
It's a really fascinating application of high-energy physics. Essentially, instead of importing liquid fuel, these Agridot stations take localized organic waste.
Like what kind of waste?
This could be jungle biomass they clear out, or discarded tires found in illegal dump sites, or even municipal dairy waste. They feed this waste into a sealed chamber and expose it to a plasma arc. We are talking about temperatures approaching 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
So they're basically throwing jungle rot and old tires into a contained electric tornado.
Effectively, yes. At those extreme temperatures, the waste doesn't just burn. Combustion requires oxygen. Instead, the molecular bonds of the waste are completely broken down.
Wow.
Complex hydrocarbons are shattered into their elemental components, primarily carbon monoxide and hydrogen. This mixture is called synthesis gas, or syngas.
Okay, so you have this really hot gas. How does that power a drone?
The station then uses a catalytic chemical process, specifically the Fischer-Tropsch process, to recombine those elemental carbon and hydrogen molecules into clean, ASTM-grade synthetic liquid diesel and off-grid electricity.
It makes diesel out of gas.
Exactly. It's a gas-to-liquid, or GTL, process happening right there in the jungle. The Pawnee command centers simply pull up to these mobile trailers, refuel their hybrid rotary generators with the synthetic diesel, and then use that electrical power to continuously recharge the drone fleets docked on their flatbeds.
That is wild.
It creates a closed-loop, 100% off-grid energy ecosystem.
It is genuinely remarkable. They literally feed the jungle into a plasma reactor to power the drones that hunt the snakes.
Exactly.
So Pawnee Mobility has successfully built this indestructible, self-fueling mechanical army. But as impressive as the titanium fasteners and the rotary engines are, without a sophisticated brain to direct it, it's just a bunch of metal blundering around in the dark.
Very expensive metal.
Right. The vehicles need to know where to go, and the drones need to know how to see. This is where Dereticular comes in, right? They provide the edge computing software layer.
Correct. If the hardware is the muscle, Dereticular is the central nervous system. They utilize a microkernel operating system called RIOS.
Now, I want to pause on the word microkernel, because the blueprints really stress how important this is for the vehicle's stability, especially compared to a normal monolithic kernel like what runs on most of our laptops.
You're touching on a crucial distinction for autonomous hardware there. In a standard monolithic operating system, everything, the file system, the device drivers, the user interface, it all runs in the same central memory space.
Right.
If a minor component crashes, like, say, the audio driver, it can bring down the entire system and cause a blue screen of death.
which is annoying on a laptop, but...
You cannot afford a blue screen of death when a 2-ton vehicle is navigating a limestone cliff.
Right. If the touchscreen crashes, you really don't want the brakes to stop working.
Precisely. A microkernel architecture like RYOS compartmentalizes everything. The core kernel only handles the most essential functions, memory management and basic communication. Every other function runs in isolated user spaces.
Okay, I see.
So if the drone bay door sensor crashes, it resets itself independently without ever touching the vehicle's navigation or drivetrain systems.
That makes total sense.
Furthermore, RYOS communicates natively with the Pawnee vehicle's CAN bus hardware.
The CAN bus, that's the controller area network, right? The vehicle's internal nervous system.
Yes. Most aftermarket software just plugs into a diagnostic port and reads surface level data. But because RYOS is integrated at the CAN bus level, it has deep native telematics control.
It sees everything.
Everything. It monitors individual wheel slip, battery cell temperatures, and suspension health in real time. And overseeing all of this local data is a persistent artificial intelligence known as Remnant.
Remnant. It sounds incredibly ominous.
A bit, yes.
And what makes Remnant so unique isn't just how smart it is, but where it physically operates. Because usually when we think of AI, you know, we picture massive climate-controlled data centers in the cloud processing billions of parameters requiring massive fiber-optic internet bandwidth.
But this operation is happening deep in a remote Pacific jungle.
Right. There is no cloud. There are no cell towers out there.
The system is designed to operate entirely in what they call island mode. It is completely air-gapped, meaning it has zero reliance on public internet or external cloud infrastructure.
So how do they communicate?
To allow the drones, the ground rovers, and the 12 command centers to talk to each other and share hunting data, DeRaticular deploys 350 solar-powered Tri-Fi wireless mesh relay pods.
I really want to break down how a mesh network differs from normal Wi-Fi because it's vital to how the swarm actually survives. If I have Wi-Fi in my house, my phone talks to a central router. If that router breaks, the whole house loses internet.
But a mesh network is different.
Right.
A mesh network is a decentralized self-healing topology. Instead of every device talking to a central hub, every node in the network, every Tri-Fi pod, every UTV, every curb car acts as a router, they pass data node to node.
Okay, so if one goes down...
If a tree falls and crushes three Tri-Fi pods, the network doesn't go down. Remnant simply calculates a new path and routes the data around the damaged area through the surviving nodes. It creates a highly resilient, private, high-bandwidth data fabric across the entire island.
And Remnant exists dynamically within this localized mesh. It processes all this incoming data using edge-native tensor processing units, or TPUs, that are embedded directly inside the Pawnee vehicles.
TPUs are specialized hardware accelerators designed specifically for the matrix multiplication tasks that neural networks require.
Unlike standard CPUs, right?
Yes. Unlike standard CPUs, which process data linearly, TPUs can process massive arrays of data simultaneously. This is what allows Remnant to sit in the jungle and dynamically route 2,500 drones in real time.
Wow.
It instantly shifts flight paths based on where the ground rovers are detecting snake activity without ever needing to phone home to a mainland server.
So Remnant clearly has the computing power to direct the swarm, but here is another massive conceptual hurdle I hit while reading the gap analysis, optical occlusion. The canopy of this jungle is incredibly dense. It's pitch black at night. It's often raining heavily. How do the drones actually see the snakes? The documents note that standard visible spectrum cameras, even high-end night vision, have a pathetic 15% success rate in these conditions.
Standard optics fail because they only see the reflective surfaces of the outer leaves. The wet leaves scatter the light, creating overwhelming visual noise.
So what's the solution?
To pierce the canopy, the genotypic drones are equipped with advanced multispectral sensors. They don't just rely on visible light. They combine near-infrared, high-resolution thermal, and low-light visible imagery into a single data stream.
And they have a specific localized AI model to process this, which DeRaticular uniquely calls their hemp-grade AI.
The branding aside, it refers to a ruggedized, heavily filtered neural network. The challenge isn't just seeing the heat, it's filtering out the noise. The hemp-grade AI is trained specifically to ignore severe visual artifacts like heavy rain, shifting shadows from wind, and the thermal reflection of wet leaves.
So it's not looking for the visual shape of a snake, because the snake is perfectly camouflaged. It's looking for the temperature.
The AI is specifically trained to isolate the thermal differential. A brown tree snake is cold-blooded, meaning its body temperature matches its surroundings. But during and immediately after a rainstorm, the foliage cools down rapidly.
But the snake doesn't.
The snake's dense muscle mass retains heat slightly longer than a thin, wet leaf. The Genoptic sensor detects that minute, fractional degree of thermal differential.
That is incredible.
It isolates the specific thermal signature of the snake against the background of rain-cooled foliage, identifies the target instantly at the edge beneath the canopy, and coordinates the drone to make the mechanical capture.
Okay, so the drone spots the thermal signature, swoops in, neutralizes or captures the snake, and a curved car ground rover retrieves it.
Yes.
But here is where the system design gets incredibly paranoid, and for very good reason. The documents highlight a major operational risk called AI input manipulation or duplication spoofing.
The human element.
Right. Basically, if you are going to pay people a bounty for dead snakes, human nature and history dictate that someone is going to try to cheat the system. Like, look at the cobra effect in colonial India, where people started breeding cobras just to kill them and collect the bounty.
Exactly.
The risk here is that an operator might submit the same dead snake twice, or bring in dead snakes from a neighboring island, or, I don't know, hold up a highly realistic synthetic rubber fake to the drone's camera. How does Remnant guarantee, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that every single snake is unique and freshly killed on Guam?
The anti-spoofing mechanism is perhaps the most impressive technical achievement of the entire Sovereign stack. When a unit retrieves a snake, it runs it through an integrated and closed imaging bay on the Pawnee vehicle.
Okay.
Remnant then executes a highly rigorous four-step verification sequence to generate what they call a proof of eradication, or PoE.
This four-step process is wild. Step one is the multispectral scan, right? The bay hits the specimen with intense thermal, near-infrared, and visible light to gather the raw baseline data.
Step two is biometric profiling. The AI takes that scan and measures the total length, weight, and cubic volume of the snake.
Oh, and the scales.
Crucially, yes. It maps the unique lateral scale patterns along the snake's body. Much like a human fingerprint, every snake has a slightly different geometric arrangement of scales. The system logs this exact geometric pattern.
Okay, so that's step two. Step three is state verification. This is the step that totally defeats the spoofers.
Yes. State verification is where the system proves the biology. The AI monitors the specimen inside the bay over a set time frame to measure active thermal dissipation, muscle tone decay, and body posture. It measures the cooling curve.
The cooling curve.
Right. A recently deceased biological organism loses heat in a very specific, mathematically predictable curve.
It checks to make sure the body is actively losing heat. That proves it was alive recently and is actively cooling down. It means an operator didn't just thaw a frozen snake out of a cooler, and it proves it isn't a rubber fake. It has to be freshly dead.
And finally, step four is the cryptographic hash. Once the AI verifies the unique biometrics and confirms the thermal state, it generates a unique cryptographic certificate.
And what's in that hash?
This hash binds the snake's biometric signature, the precise GPS coordinates of the capture, the timestamp, and the hardware ID of the specific drone that caught it into a single immutable string of data. This proof of eradication is then written directly to the local air-gapped blockchain ledger, known as the Locutus ledger.
But wait, what stops an operator from just hacking the video feed before it reaches the AI and injecting a digitally generated video of a snake?
The physical hardware prevents it. The system utilizes hardware-rooted TPM chips, trusted platform modules.
Explain how a TPM chip works in this context, because I see this acronym a lot in cybersecurity.
Think of a TPM chip as an unforgeable wax seal that is physically baked into the silicon of the camera lens itself. The cryptographic key doesn't live in the software where it can be hacked. It lives in the physical hardware of the lens.
Okay, so it's a physical lock.
When the drone's camera records the video of the capture, the TPM chip physically signs the video stream at the point of origin. When Remnant receives the video, it checks the signature. If someone tries to inject a fake video file from a laptop, it won't have the hardware-level cryptographic signature from the drone's lens, and Remnant will instantly reject it.
Consider the implications of that level of security for a second. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this localized processing doesn't just prevent someone from double-dipping on a bounty. It creates a mathematically unspoofable audit trail. You cannot cheat the capture. The hardware physics and the biological cooling curves make it impossible.
Absolutely impossible.
And why is it so crucial that the AI mathematically proves every single snake is unique and freshly dead? Because every dead snake is literally being minted into cryptocurrency.
This is the pivot point where we shift from ecology and engineering into radical economics. The documents contain a scathing critique of the traditional model for government conservation, which is known as cost plus fixed fee contracting.
Cost plus is how the government buys almost everything. They hire a contractor, they pay them an hourly rate for their labor, they reimburse them for all their equipment and fuel, and then they add a guaranteed fixed profit margin on top.
The fundamental flaw with the cost plus model in an ecological context is that the operator gets paid for their time and effort, regardless of the actual outcome.
Right?
There is high administrative overhead, massive delays in performance reviews, and zero direct correlation between the millions of dollars spent and the actual reduction in the snake population.
It creates a totally perverse incentive. If you get paid by the hour to hunt snakes and you get reimbursed for your trucks, you are financially incentivized to never actually run out of snakes. If you eradicate them all, you lose your job.
Precisely.
So the SES team proposes tearing up that entire model and replacing it with a paper snake, or PPS, model. They are shifting the paradigm to an outcome-oriented marketplace.
The mechanism of the PPS model is remarkably elegant. When that drone captures a snake and Remnant generates that unscoofable proof of eradication hash on the Locutus ledger, that hash acts as an automated, undeniable invoice.
A smart contract, basically.
Exactly. The submission of that valid POE automatically triggers a smart contract.
Mm.
The system instantly mints and issues a digital utility token called the SESVRN token directly to the digital wallet of the specific field operator whose drone made the capture.
And the bounties aren't static. The system dynamically scales the payouts. The AI adjusts the token reward based on the geographic and topological difficulty of the capture.
Yes, dynamic pricing.
If a drone catches a snake in a highly degraded, flat, easy-to-reach area near a road, the bounty is lower. But if an operator risks their hardware to hunt down a snake in a highly isolated vertical cliff face canopy enclave that is deemed critical to clear for bird reintroduction, the smart contract pays out a significantly higher premium.
It actively financially incentivizes the operators to tackle the hardest zones first.
It's so smart.
The dynamic pricing ensures the hardest areas aren't ignored. But what makes this a true functioning economy is that it is a closed loop system. The field operators who earn these SEVURN tokens don't just immediately cash them out to U.S. dollars.
Right.
They operate within an integrated cohort, and they use these tokens to purchase the resources they need to sustain continuous operations.
I tried to think of an analogy for this, and the closest I could get is a casino or maybe a high-tech arcade. Think of an arcade where you earn tokens by winning games, but those tokens are also what you use to buy the electricity to run the arcade machines, or you can cash them out at the prize counter.
That works perfectly.
If I'm an operator running a fleet of Pawnee UTVs, I earn SEVZRN tokens for the snakes my drones catch. I then take those tokens and digitally transfer them to Agridot Energy to pay for my synthetic biofuel refills.
Right.
I pay TriFi Wireless and tokens for the high bandwidth mesh network data I need to run my drones. I can even use the tokens to buy spare ogre skin armor plates or new genopytic sensors from the cohort suppliers.
It creates a frictionless, high-velocity internal economy. It eliminates third-party banking fees. It avoids credit card processing delays, which can cripple cash flow in remote areas. And it ensures that the capital recirculates entirely within the cohort to fund continuous 247 operations.
The tokens move at the speed of the mesh network.
Exactly. But, as you might expect, introducing cryptocurrency into a federal project raises immediate, severe regulatory alarms.
Oh, absolutely. When I read this section, my skepticism peaked. I thought, there is no way in hell the U.S. Department of Defense, or the USDA, is going to agree to pay out decentralized cryptocurrency tokens to robotic drone operators.
Right. Federal auditors would have a collective heart attack.
The government operates on strict oversight, not anonymous digital wallets.
Your skepticism is entirely warranted, and it was shared by the project architects. The primary threat identified in their SWOT analysis is regulatory procurement compliance. Utilizing digital currencies for government contracts requires strict alignment with the Federal Acquisition Regulations, or FAR. Federal agencies cannot, by law, disperse public treasury funds directly into decentralized crypto wallets.
So how do they bridge that massive regulatory gap? How do they satisfy the federal auditors while keeping the speed of the blockchain?
They solve it through an architectural structure that Melissa, the principal partner at Inventures Capital, calls a split ledger gateway.
A split ledger gateway.
Inventures acts as the financial bridge. They manage the actual federal cash, the standard U.S. dollars provided by the DOD and the USDA. This fiat currency is held in a highly secure, heavily audited, FAR-compliant federal escrow account.
So the government money stays in a traditional, boring bank account.
Precisely. The Lacutus ledger, where the ISSVRN tokens actually live and circulate between the operators, stays entirely internal and physically air-gapped from the public internet.
The government auditors never even see it.
They never touch, see, or interact with the crypto tokens. Instead, Inventures treats the ISSVRN token merely as an internal unit of accounting, a digital tally of verified work.
Okay.
Periodically, the gateway system audits the operator's token balances on the internal ledger, buys those tokens back, and settles the accounts by wiring standard fiat U.S. dollars from the escrow account directly into the operator's traditional, heavily regulated bank accounts.
It's the casino cashier window. The government is the bank vault. The vault only deals in cash with the cashier. The players inside the casino use the chips to play the games and pay for drinks at lightning speed without waiting for credit checks.
Exactly.
When they are done, they go to the cashier, hand in the chips, and get cash deposited to their bank. It satisfies the federal auditors because they are just paying standard USD invoices from an escrow account for verified, audited services rendered. But internally, out in the jungle, the cohort gets all the speed, automation, and dynamic bounty adjustments of a smart contract blockchain.
The structural elegance of the split ledger is profound. This matters enormously to the listener because it represents a viable template to completely eliminate bureaucratic bloat in government projects.
Yeah, the taxpayer is no longer funding open-ended, flat-rate labor where millions of dollars vanish into administrative overhead and delayed paperwork.
They are only paying for verified, mathematically audited, biologically proven ecological results. If a snake isn't eradicated, the taxpayer doesn't pay a single dime. The financial risk is entirely shifted to the operators.
Which brings up a very important logistical question. We've talked about the technical architecture, the drone swarms, the plasma reactors, and the crypto ledgers. But who exactly is putting the actual U.S. dollars into this escrow vault to back these tokens in the first place?
Follow the money.
Right. Let's look at the 10-year pro forma financial statement and figure out how a project with a staggering $101.5 million budget over 6 years is actually economically viable.
The financial underwriting of this project is a masterclass in aligned incentives. The funding sources are highly diverse and strategic, representing multiple disparate stakeholders who all share a deep financial incentive to see the snake eradicated. Let's start with the primary underwriter, the federal government. Specifically, the Department of Defense.
The DoD is putting up serious capital. According to the pro forma, they are paying $18 million a year initially, during the intense setup and core push phases, eventually scaling down to a $5 million a year retainer in the later biosecurity lock phase. Now, the obvious question is, why is the military spending $20 million to hunt snakes in the jungle?
It comes down to operational readiness and strategic vulnerability. Anderson Air Force Base and Naval Base Guam are critical forward operating hubs for the U.S. military in the Pacific.
Okay.
However, they are highly vulnerable to localized power outages caused by the snakes. SES is effectively securing these military enclaves to ensure continuous power and prevent biosecurity violations on departing cargo planes.
Mm. The power outage issue ties directly into the municipal funding layer, too. The Guam Power Authority, or GPA, is acting as a secondary underwriter. And the reason for this involves a relatively new biological discovery about the snakes.
You're referring to lasso locomotion.
Yes. The researchers only documented this behavior in 2021. It completely changed the understanding of the snake's mobility. Traditionally, snakes climb by gripping rough bark, but the brown tree snake developed a unique ability to loop its body around completely smooth, wide, vertical cylinders-like utility poles.
It's quite a sight.
They grip with their tails to form a literal lasso and systematically shimmy up the pole. They can scale concrete and metal structures that engineers previously thought were totally snake-proof.
And the consequence of that locomotion is severe. When they reach the top of the utility pole, their long bodies frequently bridge the gap between live electrical lines and grounded transformers. Zap. This causes extensive short circuits and ground faults. The economic data in the documents shows that these snake-induced outages cost the GPA and the local economy $4.5 million every single year in physical repairs, blown transformers, and lost commercial productivity.
So if you are the GPA losing $4.5 million a year to fried snakes, it makes absolute financial sense to pay SES a retainer to stop it. The pro forma shows GPA paying $1.5 million in year one, scaling up to $3.5 million a year by year five, as grid outages reliably drop towards zero. By deploying the robotic swarms to clear the areas around the utility corridors, SES directly protects the power grid, and GPA basically pays them a portion of their avoided losses. It's a win-win.
But the most fascinating economic concept modeled in this pro forma is the biosecurity insurance. The state of Hawaii pays a flat $2 million a year subvention fee to the project.
On the surface, that makes no sense. Why would Hawaii taxpayers pay $2 million a year to solve an ecological problem on an island almost 4,000 miles away?
It comes down to the mechanics of global shipping and the fragility of isolated ecosystems. Guam is a primary commercial and military shipping hub for the Pacific. Cargo planes and shipping containers constantly move between Guam and Honolulu.
Right.
If a pregnant female brown tree snake hitchhikes in the wheel well of an aircraft or deep inside a cargo container and manages to establish a breeding population in Hawaii, the economic and ecological models are terrifying.
Because Hawaii's ecosystem is virtually identical to Guam's pre-invasion state.
Yeah.
Hawaii has an incredibly fragile ecosystem of endemic ground-nesting birds and absolutely no natural reptilian predators to keep a snake population in check.
Exactly. The multiplier effect of an invasion would be catastrophic. Thorough economic models estimate that an established brown tree snake population in Hawaii would cause between $456 million and $761 million in damages annually.
Just massive.
That includes devastating hits to their ecotourism industry, massive medical costs from snake bites to citizens, identical power infrastructure damages, and the total collapse of the unique biodiversity.
So from the perspective of the Hawaiian government, paying SES a $2 million a year retainer is the cheapest insurance policy in the history of the world. It maintains a literal biosecurity firewall at Guam's ports, utilizing the drones to capture the snakes before they can ever export.
But the most innovative and scalable revenue stream, the one that elevates this from a bespoke government defense contract into a globally replicable business model, is the monetization of ecological restoration through biodiversity and carbon credits.
Let's deeply unpack this, because this is where the financial loop truly closes and connects back to the biology we discussed at the very beginning. We established the ecological reality. Without the fruit-eating birds, 70% of Guam's native trees have no seed dispersal. New tree seedling recruitment dropped by 92%. The forest is stagnating and failing to sequester new carbon.
But as SES deploys the Pawnee drone swarms and systematically eradicates the snakes block by block, they create secure, heavily monitored, snake-free havens.
Like safe zones.
Safe zones. This provides the safety required for the USDA and local wildlife refuges to finally begin releasing captive-bred native birds, like the Micronesian starling, back into the wild. As the avian population rebounds, seed scarification and dispersal resume, the forest begins to naturally and rapidly regenerate.
And here's where the technology double dips in the most brilliant way. Those genopactic multispectral drones flying over the canopy aren't just looking for the thermal signatures of snakes. While they are flying, they're simultaneously running real-time spatial mapping and photogrammetry of the forest canopy.
Harvesting data.
Exactly. They use their sensors to measure the vegetative health, the canopy moisture levels, and the exact volumetric growth of the newly sprouted tree seedlings.
The drones gather deeply audited, unspoofable environmental data. SES takes this granular data and uses it to issue highly verified GROM biodiversity credits and carbon offsets to global corporate markets.
And companies want those.
Oh, these markets are desperate for high-quality, verifiable ecological offsets.
According to the pro forma, this specific revenue stream generates $0 in the first 3 years because the active eradication squeeze is still happening and the trees haven't grown yet. But as the canopy matures and the drone data mathematically proves the ecological lift, the revenue from selling these credits scales up rapidly to $6 million per year in years 7 through 10.
It's incredibly lucrative.
The proceeds from these global corporate markets are then channeled back to Inventures, who uses the cash to buy back and retire the SESVRN tokens, creating a completely self-sustaining financial loop that doesn't rely solely on government grants.
This raises an important question about how we value our ecosystems. Historically, environmental conservation has been viewed entirely as a charitable expense, a sunk cost funded by taxpayers or donations, with very little financial accountability or return on investment.
Right, you just throw money at it and hope it helps.
But this blueprint completely flips the script. by turning ecological restoration into a highly lucrative, multi-layered business model combining military defense budgets, utility grid savings, biosecurity insurance premiums, and global carbon markets conservation actually becomes profitable.
A wild.
It aligns the aggressive financial incentives of rugged defense contractors, bleeding-edge AI engineers, and Wall Street capital directly with the exact metrics of ecological recovery.
So what does this all mean? It is an absolute masterpiece of aligned incentives. Let's quickly synthesize the sheer scale of what we've covered before we get to the final, genuinely mind-bending twist of this deep dive.
Yeah, let's recap.
Pawnee Mobility and Deriticular have built an indestructible, air-gapped, off-grid robotic army. They are deploying 2,500 VTOL drones and 50 ground rovers, powered continuously by plasma gasification units running on jungle waste.
A literal sci-fi army.
This swarm is dynamically managed by an edge computing AI that hunts camouflaged snakes in the dark using thermal differentials. They fund this through a AFR-compliant split-ledger cryptocurrency model that pays operators per verified kill, secured by hardware-rooted cryptography, and they offset the long-term costs by selling the resulting restored forest as biodiversity credits.
It is a stunning, comprehensive technological achievement.
It really is. But as we wrap up, we have to look beyond the drones, beyond the hardware, and beyond the blockchain, because the white papers contain a final detail about the endgame that changes the context of everything we just discussed. What actually happens in the final phase of this 10-year plan?
Buried in the documentation under Phase 3, the architects concede a pretty sobering reality. While the robotic swarms are highly effective and essential for the core eradication and establishing secure beachheads, physical hunting alone, even with 2,500 drones, is likely not the ultimate permanent solution to an island-wide infestation.
You just can't catch every single one physically.
To achieve total, irreversible eradication, they're relying on a program formally initiated by DARPA in early 2026, known as the Guardian Program. The specific stated goal of this program is the deployment of next-generation genetic drive technologies.
I really want you, the listener, to stop and think about that term for a second. We are talking about the release of CRISPR-Cas9 homing endonuclease gene drives.
Yes. The program focuses on engineering genetically modified brown tree snakes in a laboratory. But genetic drive is designed to specifically target and disrupt highly conserved genes that are critical for female fertility, or alternatively, to heavily bias the offspring's sex ratios entirely toward males.
Let's break down the biology of why a gene drive is so uniquely powerful compared to normal genetics. If you remember high school biology, Mendelian inheritance dictates that an offspring has a roughly 50% chance of inheriting a specific gene from a parent.
Right, the 50-50 rule.
If you release a few sterile snakes, the trait usually dilutes and disappears in the wild population over a few generations.
A homing gene drive aggressively circumvents Mendelian inheritance. It utilizes the CRISPR-Cas9 mechanism to actively cut the wild-type chromosome in the germline cells, forcing the cell's own DNA repair machinery to copy the gene drive onto the cut chromosome.
So it overrides the 50-50 rule. It forces the edit to spread.
Exactly. It effectively guarantees near 100% inheritance of the modified trait in all subsequent offspring. When a small number of these genetically modified snakes are released into the wild population, the sterility or sex biasing trait spreads exponentially through the generations.
A biological time bomb.
Within a mathematically predictable time frame, the lack of fertile females causes a complete demographic and fertility collapse of the invasive population. The species simply breeds itself out of existence.
I want you to really think about the profound implications of that revelation. We just spent an hour detailing a highly coordinated $100 million operation. The Baja suspension UTVs, the nonstick ogre skin armor, the genoptic multispectral swarms, the air gap tri-fi mesh networks, the plasma gasification reactors, the unspoofable blockchain ledgers.
All of it.
What if this massive robotic drone army isn't actually the main weapon? What if all of that incredible sprawling technology is merely the physical containment setup, the secure, highly monitored perimeter required by federal regulators to safely unleash a genetic override on an entire species?
The documentation strongly suggests that conclusion. It forces us to recognize that we are entering a new era of intervention. Biological engineering, decentralized economics, and autonomous robotics are no longer separate fields of study. They've been integrated into a single, cohesive, sovereign stack designed specifically to manually rewrite the ecology of our planet.
It brings us right back to where we started our deep dive today. Imagine standing in that silent, humid limestone forest. You look up at the dense green canopy, knowing there are millions of predators hiding in the leaves responsible for the extinction of the birds. But now, you don't just hear the suffocating silence.
Right.
You hear the low, steady hum of a Pawnee rotary engine in the distance. You hear the sharp whir of a Genapetic drone locking onto a fractional thermal signature in the pitch black of the canopy. The silence of the forest isn't permanent anymore. It is actively being dismantled, algorithm by algorithm, token by token, gene by gene.
It's an incredible future to ponder.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. We encourage you to keep questioning how these rapidly converging technologies might rewrite the future of our planet's ecosystems. Until next time.